Shalom, and welcome to the Israel Policy Pod. I'm Neri Zilber, a journalist based in Tel Aviv and a policy advisor to Israel Policy Forum. We have a great episode for you this week. Israel Policy Forum's very own Chief Policy Officer Michael Koplow and Shira Efron, Israel Policy Forum's Diana and Guilford Glaser Foundation Director of Policy Research, are back with us to discuss a bunch of the big issues happening all across the Middle East, including Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the West Bank, and Turkey. But first, a few thoughts from me. Israel has garnered a lot of names and monikers over the years. Startup nation, election nation after five elections in less than 4 years, obviously the Jewish state, the Holy Land, etc., etc. But I'd like to submit a new name for Israel, committee nation. In recent days, we got word of not one, but two new committees set up by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to tackle deep-seated and long-standing issues. One for the high cost of living, which we touched on in last week's episode, and the second committee to tackle the growing epidemic of violent crime and murders in the Arab-Israeli community, which I hope to touch on very soon here on this podcast. Both committees will be helmed by Bibi himself. We can also add to this list the committee still working away at the president's residence to find a quote-unquote compromise for the judicial overhaul issue. But what's the old joke about committees? If you really want to kill and bury an issue, then form a committee to address it. I'm old enough to remember a previous committee that was formed to address the high cost of living in Israel back in 2011. In the wake of the massive social justice protest movement. That committee succeeded in killing off the protest movement, but it did nothing to reverse the soaring prices here on pretty much everything, quite the opposite, as every Israeli knows. And let's be honest, you don't really need a committee to figure out the issue of crime in Arab-Israeli communities. All it takes is a genuine commitment by the national government to address the issue and to provide the required resources. The last government under Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid made it a priority and managed to reduce the high murder rate. This new government, with National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir at the helm, has basically ignored the issue, and the murder rates have tripled. Over 90 Arab-Israeli citizens have been killed since the start of this year, i.e. since the Netanyahu government took power, over 90 citizens. But the real issue with all these committees that have been announced is that, like we said, they're deep-rooted and long-standing issues. They didn't start yesterday or last month or 5 years ago, and yet Netanyahu, Israel's longest-serving prime minister, who has very literally been in charge here for the past 14 years, save the 18-month stretch of Bennett and Lapid, is now shocked to find out that they need to be addressed. Maybe someone should form a committee to find out why it took so long for the prime minister to form these committees. Let's get to Michael Koplow and Shira Efron. Hi, Michael. Hi, Shira. Welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Neri. Hi, Shira.
Hi, Neri. Hi, Michael.
How do you both? We just all saw each other here in Israel the other week, and we'll see each other again in a few weeks too. Action-packed summer, and dare I say an action-packed podcast with a lot to get into across the Middle East. But I wanted to start here with you both with the big news and sad news from this weekend, which was the deadly terror attack on the Israel-Egypt border on Saturday. Three Israeli soldiers were killed by a rogue Egyptian border policeman who stole across the border through the heavily fortified border fence and killed the Israeli troops. The incident, I would argue, raised several real and serious questions about the IDF's tactical deployment on that frontier. That's usually a fairly quiet border, except, of course, for the drug smugglers. But that's a slightly different issue. But both sides, both Israel and Egypt, are downplaying the strategic impact of this event with the close ties and the peace treaty obviously still in place and still remaining strong. So with that, Shira, let's start with you. What did you make of this highly unusual and tragic incident? Do you think there's any real strategic damage that's going to come out of it or any real strategic implications that we should take from it?
You know, it's a good question. I think it's too early to say. You described it best. It's very unusual, right? This is the first time in the last decade that I remember there was an incident of an Egyptian security person, right? Hurting IDF soldiers. This is not something that has happened. It's considered fairly a very quiet border. There's a lot of smuggling and other issues, but it's not a security threat, which is the reason why this front, right, the southern front, has been probably at the bottom of the priority list of the IDF in terms of investments of resources and, you know, the types of personnel you had there. So tactically, we have an issue here, right? How come this security, you know, you have an Egyptian official able to penetrate Israel, kill three soldiers? It took a lot of time until this incident was reported, until they were able to reach out to him. Will this require a change in resources, in allocation? Will it mark a trend? We all hope not. I think you said it, right? The Israelis and the Egyptians are downplaying it, and they're cooperating fully in the investigations, and it seems like he worked alone. It was more of a lone wolf issue. Anecdotally, it's interesting that in Egypt, publicly, the story is very different. The story is that he chased drug smugglers into Israel in a heroic act and got killed inside Israel. But we know that in the actual conversations with their Israeli counterparts, the Egyptians, you know, acknowledge what had happened, and they hope this doesn't mark a new trend of radicalization. I'll just say that in 2011, you know, it was the Sisi himself, that the president, the Egyptian president, who was head of intelligence at the time, he had warned back then against radicalization in the Sinai, and that would endanger sort of the peace treaty with Israel. There would be attacks from Sinai in Israel. So it's not that it's not on the minds of others. Now we will have to see if this is a you know, sort of just remains an unusual event, or if there are more.
Right. And it's worth mentioning, it was a 22-year-old border policeman from Egypt. Maybe some kind of radicalization religiously, but it's looking more and more like it was suicide via soldier. That's the prevailing assumption now, a few days out. Michael, what did you make of this incident?
I don't think it's as much of a story about Israel-Egypt relations as actually a story about Israel and the IDF. You know, on the Israel-Egypt part of this, Shira is absolutely correct. You know, this is such an unusual event. And the fact that it's so unusual, I think, says a lot about the Israel-Egypt security relationship. One of the things that I did not know before this attack happened, that I was kind of stunned to learn, is that these gates in the fence that are there to enable Israel to cross the border in times of necessity were secured only by zip ties. You know, the guy took and just cut the zip ties, which perhaps more than anything else says just how little Israel generally is worried about this border, and, you know, how much trust there is between the two sides, at least on security. So, you know, I do think this is anomalous. Certainly historically, it's anomalous. I would be surprised if this is the beginning of, you know, more of these types of attacks with any frequency. Netanyahu and Sisi spoke today and reaffirmed their strong relationship, and Sisi offered his condolences. And so I don't think this is going to really impact Israel-Egypt relations. But this is certainly not the first time in the last few months that we have seen something worrisome with regard to Israeli military preparedness. There was the infiltrator from the north who, you know, that Hezbollah sent from Lebanon, who literally got 70 kilometers into Israel, planted a roadside bomb, turned around, and was on his way back. You know, we have this infiltration from Egypt, and not just infiltration, which, you know, in a extremely lightly defended mountainous part of the border with ravines, you know, so fine, the guy cuts the zip ties and gets in, but then he's able to kill three soldiers. That's pretty worrisome. Today, Kobi Shabtai, the police commissioner, testified to the Knesset that he doesn't think the police are able to deal with any type of multi-front outbreak of violence, and says that the Lod police force is missing 30% of its required officers. So I think that, you know, all these together tell a story about some worrisome signs for the IDF, for Israeli security, for Israeli military preparedness. And I think that this infiltration from Egypt is just part of this story, as opposed to telling us something terribly worrisome about Israel-Egypt relations.
You stole the words right out of my mouth, Michael.
That's the advantage I get by not being the host, Mary.
Yeah. I'm very polite, and then I get to have my say. But no, I do agree with you wholeheartedly, and also with Shira. You know, I think Israel-Egypt ties will be fine. This is really kind of an outlier. But like you said, Michael, it is worrying that at least the perception of Israel, right, as this fortress with all these very sophisticated border fences, and even in many cases, actual walls all around the country, in the north, in the east, two times in the east, right, in the West Bank and also on the Jordanian frontier, and now in Egypt, it seems like it's a lot easier to infiltrate into Israel than we all really imagined. So there was the Megiddo bombing, like you said, Michael, a few months ago, but almost on a kind of weekly basis, we get updates from the army about smuggling attempts that are interdicted from the Jordanian frontier. And these are usually kind of guns and other other illegal things that are somehow ferried across the Jordan River into Israel.
Including sometimes by members of the Jordanian parliament.
Yes, exactly, through official border crossings. But these are only the incidents that we actually catch. And now we see that it's a lot easier to get into Israel from the Egypt border than we all imagined. And then obviously the wall and the frontier between Israel and the West Bank is porous, as we've come to know now really over the past year. But we've all known, I would argue, for many years. So it is, interesting might not be the right word, worrying, probably more accurate. And it all comes into play, right, when, say, a real war kicks off. Hezbollah has made it very clear that it wants to send forces across the border into northern Israel to even conquer a Israeli village or moshav or kibbutz. Something definitely to keep an eye on, and hopefully the generals in the IDF are acting to repair these damages. So with that, we're going to move right along. Yesterday, so we're recording this, by the way, on Tuesday, June 6th. So yesterday was June 5th. As some of you might know, it was unauspicious. I'm going to use that word maybe with a bit of irony, but an auspicious anniversary, 56 years to the start of the Six-Day War, also known as Naxa Day for Palestinians, the day of setback, literally. Michael, we'll start with you. You had a very interesting piece last week in your weekly Koplo column, laying out in detail what the priorities, quote unquote, of this current government actually are. And it can basically be summed up, correct me if I'm wrong, as further entrenchment in the West Bank, further settlement construction, and further steps on the road to a one-state reality. So lay out for us, if you could, the examples that you gave in your column. This government, it seems to me, is apparently pretty inept on most policy issues, but not on this issue.
Right, not on this issue at all. So we've all been focused on judicial overhaul, you know, I think rightly so, given the threat it presents to the version of Israeli democracy that we're used to. And it certainly seems to have been the government's priority out of the gate. And as it has slowed down, stalled, you know, we'll see what happens to it eventually. We see the government's initial priorities that we assumed it would have, and in many ways that were encapsulated in coalition agreements, coming to the fore. And so what do we see? We see the Israeli government passing a budget where 25% of the entire transportation budget for everything goes to the West Bank, despite the fact that the West Bank has 5% of the population. We see enormous coalition discretionary funds that are undoubtedly going to be spent, certainly by religious Zionism, but perhaps other parties as well, inside of the West Bank, we continue to see the extension of Israeli settlement and of the Israeli presence deep into the West Bank, encapsulated in the repeal of the disengagement law as it applies to the northern West Bank, which then enabled the return of Israelis to Chomesh and the establishment of the Chomesh Yeshiva, which was an illegal structure built on private Palestinian land and is now a more permanent illegal structure built on state land. That happened a couple of weeks ago. Just today, it was reported that there's been a request to have Israelis spend Shabbat in Eviatar, another illegal outpost that Israel actually evacuated that had been established during the fighting in May 2021, kind of under the noses of the IDF. Been empty ever since. And now, you know, Israelis want to go spend Shabbat there. And I don't think anybody should be surprised if that indeed happens. And that will just be, you know, step one in turning Eviatar into a more permanent thing. And it's not just about the folks in Hatzionut HaDatit, religious Zionism. Just today, I see right before we started recording that Nir Barkat, you know, Likud minister and somebody who I think is probably one of the leading candidates to one day succeed Netanyahu as head of Likud, spoke at the Jerusalem Post conference in New York, and says that there shouldn't be two states because there are no successful Arab democratic countries anywhere in the world, and he says the most successful governance structures are the UAE and Saudi Arabia, which in his his rendition are tribal based governance, successful autocracies, and so that's what should happen with the West Bank. It should be kind of a series of tribal autonomous regions that won't be democratic, won't be connected. That's how it should be. And of course, not coincidentally, I think that vision comports very well with Israel staying in the West Bank forever, deepening its presence wherever it wants, kind of leaving little pockets of Palestinians to sort of do as they please in a very limited area, in a very limited way. So this is where this government is going. And that's, by the way, I should mention even before we get to giant red lines traditionally like E1, where there's going to be a hearing this month that could pave the way for E1, which is right outside of Maale Adumim and a longstanding American and European red line. There's going to be a hearing this month that can pave the way for E1 to finally be built. So we're seeing the government race ahead on all of these things. And this is what it cares about. This is what it's doing. And I have to stress, it's not just Smotrich. It's not just Ben-Gvir. At this point, Likud, in many ways, is just as hardline on these issues as the smaller, more right-wing, more religious parties are. So nobody should be surprised that this is the government's priority. And it's unlike judicial overhaul. It's not going to be paused. It's not going to stop. If there's anything that I think has the ability to bring this government down, it would be Netanyahu deciding to sort of put the brakes on the West Bank. And I think if there's one thing he's not really willing to do, it's that.
Yeah, just for our listeners, E1, it's the area east of Jerusalem, between Jerusalem and Maale Adumim, very controversial and strategic piece of land that if Israel started building there, then arguably that would forestall any potential future viable and contiguous Palestinian state, which is why successive U.S. administrations have urged Israel not to take that step. Would be very bad news if this government actually started moving forward building an E1. Shira, what did you make of all these resources? And the budget was a good kind of milestone in seeing what they're actually apportioning for the settlement project in the West Bank. But what did you make of it all? And also, we saw a very stern message from Washington, especially with regard to the illegal Chomosh outpost, saying that Israel had reneged on promises and commitments it had made both to the Biden administration in previous summits in Jordan and Egypt, and also reneging on prior commitments made by Ariel Sharon to George W. Bush back in the mid-2000s.
Yeah. So I guess 2 points. First of all, on the priorities, you know, I agree with Michael 100%. And I think as someone who also, you know, I don't just look at it through the lens of, you know, what does it mean for the future of the peace process, the ability to, you know, have a two-state solution and the viability of a Palestinian state, right? It's not just about a settlement. It's also as someone who lives in Israel and needs to pay, you know, and pay, I pay most of my income to taxes that serve completely different constituencies, right? It goes to the ultra-Orthodox Haredi population, and it goes to the settlements. We see it with transportation, and I don't know if our listeners have been to Israel. It's the whole, like, it's a transportation disaster, but a quarter of the budget is going to the West Bank. We see it, obviously, in other things. E1 was mentioned. There's actually a discussion that was scheduled for next week. Most previous discussions have been postponed, and it's likely that this one would be postponed also, but who knows, right? Because Israel has been, it's not mine, but I like this phrase, but Israel has become this E1 threshold state. And as we keep, you know, what you thought was unthinkable before has become unthinkable, and Chomish is really the case in point, that maybe E1, you will have the discussion. There's also an industrial zone within the Regional Council of Samaria, Shomron, that just got budgeted. And the purpose is not, you know, industrial zone to provide labor for Palestinians. The objective is expanding and entrenching the settlements. And it's extremely concerning for a variety of reasons, and it's extremely concerning as someone who lives here. I'm just going to give it an anecdote that I don't think people understand, but you know, there was a very extreme heat wave in Israel on Friday. It's hot here in the summer, but it was an extreme heat wave. And because of excess demand for electricity, the Israeli, you know, the whole network had to be managed, and supplies, electricity power supplies were cut on purpose by design to different areas. And it was revealed that the religious towns and cities and areas in Israel were did not suffer from power cuts because of Shabbat, because they had to cook for Shabbat. Now, I'm telling you, it's Friday. I mean, the rest of us don't want to cook for Shabbat. We don't want to make dinner for our family. We don't need cooling for our food. And this goes back to what happened here in this country during COVID, right? When you had the Haredi population, religious groups saying, well, you know, funerals and weddings are very important for us, and that's why we cannot self-quarantine. I'm like, wait, the rest of us don't consider funerals and weddings important? And it's very difficult when you feel that you're deprioritized in the budget. And of course, I'm not even starting with the schools, right? And if the schools, you would say, okay, there's a affirmative action or some sort of priority budgeting for schools at the bottom of the rank, because we're trying to narrow socioeconomic education gaps. But no, right? It's for entrenching the system where you have big sects of the population who don't study any core subjects. So it's a challenge on top of a challenge. And I think that's why a lot of people in Israel are extremely frustrated. It's not just because of this, the big, 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 you know, question of, will Israel turn into a dictatorship? It's the priorities of this government and different things that are happening slowly, right? A person who is actively against LGBT community becoming head of getting in the file of being in charge of all enrichment programs in schools, right? So all these things are just happening, even without the big thing, which is part of the reason why the protests continue. And of course, when it's combined with police violence and the threat that we keep hearing from leaders in the coalition, that the reform, what they call the judicial reform and others call judicial coup, will pass. It's hard for the protest to stop and for people to sort of accept or be content with the policies that this government is promoting. I will just want to say, if you entertain me for a second, it is interesting. I think that the prime minister himself seems like he's trying to, we know we'd call it in Hebrew, like lechazlesh, to go back to routine. He had two announcements this week that I thought probably misses the old times. He tweeted that he spoke on the phone with Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI. So he's visiting Israel, Sam Altman, and because of the protests, you know, pressure, he didn't meet with Netanyahu, who wanted to meet with him. He met with the President Herzog. But Netanyahu spoke with him on the phone and issued a statement that we spoke on the phone about the importance of artificial intelligence and Israel's constructive role to play. And then he had another tweet about his conversation with Elon Musk, the future of artificial intelligence and Israel's role to play, which is like, you know, Netanyahu, a league of his own, right? He's trying to say, like, I'm speaking with all these leaders. They're not political leaders, but they are leaders nonetheless. And it's technology and it's the future. It's Israel's startup nation. So it feels to me that at least from the head, there is an attempt to go back to doing what he likes doing. But all these other things, of course, get in the way.
So it is really interesting that, yes, Netanyahu very evidently wants to at least portray business as usual, or that he's getting back to business as usual and taking care of the real priorities of the country, not having to do with the judicial overhaul issues. I don't think he's himself has mentioned it in, I think, several weeks. Maybe like a slip of the tongue after they passed the budget last week, which I touched on with Tal Shalev. But he is really making that effort. But at the same time, you know, the judicial overhaul aside, this government is actually quite negative in a whole host of other arrays. And that if judicial overhaul had never been introduced by Justice Minister Yariv Levin in the beginning of January, we'd probably be still discussing and outraged, at least us, about things like settlement construction and like subsidies for the ultra-Orthodox and you know, U.S.-Israel ties and all the like. But because of what's gone on now for the past 4 or 5 months, judicial overhaul has almost kind of sucked all the oxygen out of the room. And so once he pressed pause on that, at least for many people here and many people observing what's happening in Israel, it's kind of like, okay, well, we dodged the major bullet, and now things are quote-unquote back to normal, even though it's not normal at all, as we're trying to emphasize here, I think.
Neri, on that point, part of what worries me is that this is similar to something that we saw in 2020, which was Israel seems to be racing toward annexation, and the UAE stepped in and said, okay, annexation or normalization, you know, pick one. And Netanyahu made his choice and paused whatever moves were being made toward annexation. And everybody, you know, kind of celebrated, right? It was lauded as this great moment. Oh, wonderful. Annexation didn't happen. And yet many other worrisome, difficult things that the Israeli government were doing went on as planned. But because Netanyahu had sort of ramped things up to this crisis alarm level on annexation, when it went away, it kind of made it easier to just forget about all of the other stuff. And I think in a lot of ways, judicial overhaul has operated similarly. You know, he raced forward on what to many people seemed like a completely reckless, self-defeating proposal. In this case, you know, external actors in the form of the protesters, you know, and the political opposition, but I think, you know, mainly the protesters and the United States and international markets and everybody else stepped in. You know, at least for now, he seems to have stepped back from the brink. And so because judicial overhaul is now no longer front and center, everybody's like, wonderful, great, you know, let's kind of go back, as you say, to business as usual. And it makes it easy to forget that business as usual in many ways is also alarming. And so I would hope that, you know, in the context of all of this happening, you know, and I say this as somebody who works primarily on US policy, I would hope that, you know, within the halls of decision making in the United States, people don't lose sight of the fact that there are many things that this government is doing that run contrary to U.S. policy, that the United States doesn't like, that are troubling for the administration and troubling for Congress. And we shouldn't just all let Netanyahu off the hook on the assumption that he has paused and maybe, you know, has ended judicial overhaul. There are plenty of other things to address. And it shouldn't be that you can create a crisis and then alleviate the crisis, and everything else is sort of then seen as being perfectly fine.
Yes, the pyromaniac and the firefighter theory, right, of politics and diplomacy.
It's a great segue what Michael just said about U.S. policy. Of course, this is not the reason, but I think that one positive process that we saw with this government, right? There's Aqaba summit, and there was the meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh, and not going to go into details what these meetings were about, but the positive outcome of those meetings were that both sides, Israel and Palestinians, basically committed to the Biden administration not to engage in unilateral, non-constructive steps. This construction in Chomesh is the definition
of a
unilateral non-construction step. And you can try to think, okay, I'm not saying that the fact that we didn't have Sharm 2 allowed it to happen, but I do think that if the U.S. keeps their, you know, sort of like hands on the pulse and continue engaging and continuing following up and following through and ensuring and making sure that the parties are committed, it would be very, very helpful in the current circumstances, as the Israeli government has an agenda and the Palestinians also feel that they're not committed to anything, obviously. And everyone here is in sort of a limbo mode saying, okay, when is Sharm 2 going to happen? It was, I think, planned initially for late June. It has not, or second part of June, it has not been scheduled so far as I know. Maybe you guys heard differently. And absent any horizon on this, absent any process, and I'm not as optimistic about what the process is able to achieve, but maybe it can prevent some of the damages, and it's important for its existence, right, for the sake of a process. And we're not seeing that. So when I say U.S. policy, I'm not even, you know, I try to stay away from sort of holding the prime minister accountable and stepping outside of, you know, Israeli politics. But I think also there was U.S. leadership that seemed promising for what it was. And I think we should not miss the mark on this, and this should be pursued and continued, even though there are other priorities in, you know, in the region, and of course around the world, because you know this could be positive, and finding, you know, just trying to find a way that the fact that we don't have a Jerusalem Day coming, that we're just after a small round in Gaza, there's no Ramadan coming, you know, there's no, like, we don't see the next explosion, right? Everyone can try to use this period maybe to inject some positivity, or at least do no harm state of mind, but for that you have to have leadership from the outside and the US.
And I think that's a good point, too, that while there's no major milestone date on the horizon that could really destabilize things here on the ground, things are actually very unstable in terms of West Bank security, and especially in places like the northern West Bank where the Chomesh outpost is. It only increases friction between radical settlers and, you know, local Palestinians on the ground. And, you know, we've seen that now, I think, in recent days too, especially in and around Chomesh. So each one of those events could actually lead very easily to an explosion in and of itself. And so while we all talk about high diplomacy and various promises made or not made or broken, the reality on the ground is actually kind of skewing very negative in and of itself.
Extremely negative. I mean, you mentioned the northern West Bank, but it's also Hebron, it's also Tel Karem, it's also Jericho. I mean, it's the security situation has to be, the deterioration has to stop.
Yeah, and like you said, it requires leadership, especially on the Israeli side, but also on the Palestinian side. Okay, we'll be right back after this brief message.
Israel Policy Forum works to advance the vision of Israel as a secure, Jewish, and democratic state by strengthening support for a viable two-state outcome to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We provide constructive policy analysis and pragmatic policy recommendations, produce credible research reports, deliver thoughtful and nuanced commentary, build engaging and innovative educational content, and create informational video content covering critical issues. We're trusted as a reliable resource in Washington and the Jewish community. To explore more of our work on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, U.S.-Israel relations, Israeli politics, Israeli-Arab regional integration, and the future of two states, watch our new series of short videos on how the judicial overhaul threatens Israel's status as a secure, Jewish, and democratic state. Read the Koplow column, Chief Policy Officer Michael Koplow's weekly article on current events. Read our timely written explainers unpacking critical issues. Explore our 50 Steps Before the Deal policy resource. Or join one of our live video briefings featuring top journalists from the region. Links to all of these resources can be found in the description of this podcast. If you rely on Israel Policy Forum for credible, informational, and thoughtful analysis, please make a gift today to ensure that Israel Policy Forum's work continues to have an impact. Donate now at ipf.li/supportthepod or at the Support the Show link in the show notes.
Shira, you mentioned other priorities in the region, and that's a good segue. We're moving from Egypt to the West Bank, and now we're going due east to Saudi Arabia. And Saudi is arguably the big diplomatic story these days and potentially of our day. It's all we've been hearing about in recent weeks, about the potential of Israel normalizing relations with Saudi Arabia, maybe even in the coming months. And to get this done, the Biden administration will likely have to do the heavy lifting. Saudi wants a lot of things, and primarily from the U.S., not actually from Israel, although there may be that component too. Things like, according to reports, advanced weapons, security guarantees, a civilian nuclear program, and political rehabilitation for Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in Washington. We all know that the Biden administration is reportedly very keen on getting this deal done, although how keen they are to meet all of the Saudi demands is open to speculation. So let's speculate. Michael, let's start with you. Do you think such a deal is possible, at least politically, in Washington and Jerusalem and even in Riyadh in the coming months?
Anything is possible. but I think in, you know, this is a long shot. And, you know, people's expectations at the moment are so heightened, you know, starting at, maybe he didn't start with this, but certainly when Netanyahu listed his four priorities upon retaking office, and one of them was Israel-Saudi normalization, you know, it led to this cottage industry of speculation that this was around the corner, and, you know, all this talk from Israelis about how it's happening. And we've certainly seen things slow down, cool in a number of ways, you know, both between Israel and Saudi Arabia directly. You know, there were reports back in late fall, early winter, that direct flights between Israel and Saudi Arabia for Hajj were effectively a done deal. That still hasn't happened. You know, we had all this speculation about maybe there'd be public meetings or, you know, invitations for Netanyahu to visit places. That hasn't happened. And of course, this is on top of the Saudi-Iranian detente, which may be a good thing for the region overall, but certainly, I think, complicates things between Israel and Saudi Arabia. So, you know, we've seen a lot of this talk slow down. And ultimately, there are lots of constraints on this sort of thing happening, you know, and it goes on all sides. And I should note that Shira and I are hopefully today finishing up a report on Israel-Saudi normalization and suggesting ways in which, if it happens, it can and should benefit the Israeli-Palestinian sphere. But one of the things that we have in this report are all the constraints on each side about why this is tougher than people think. And, you know, Saudi has reportedly made demands of the United States that I don't think the United States is prepared to meet, I should say, nor should they, in my opinion, meet them. You know, they're incredibly far ranging from, you know, a U.S. blessing for Saudi civilian nuclear facilities. And, you know, we all know that civilian nuclear facilities don't necessarily remain civilian, to security guarantees that would effectively treat the Saudis like NATO, to, you know, removing any type of congressional barrier to arms sales to Saudi Arabia, no matter what those arms sales are. You know, that's obviously a lot, that's difficult for the United States. I think to the extent the Saudis are going to ask for something from the Israelis on the Palestinian front, and by the way, I'm not certain that they will, but you know, if they did, we've already spoken about this coalition and its plans for the West Bank and its vision for the future. I think that you know, even pausing the things that it's doing in return for some sort of normalization will be difficult for many of the parties in this coalition to swallow. And you know, even if you could get through all of these things, Saudi Arabia is still very unpopular in Washington on both sides. It's not just Democrats. It's, you know, many Republicans have issues with the Saudis as well. But at the moment, you also have a Democratic White House and a Democratic Senate. And Saudi Arabia still has a long ways to go in D.C., particularly with Democrats. And so, I take the Biden administration at its word that it's working on this very hard and that it sees it as a priority. But I think there are lots of stumbling blocks here. And the idea that they can all just be easily swept away, given the domestic politics in the United States and in Israel, given regional trends, kind of given everything, the idea of these can just be swept away before the end of the year and you can have a normalization agreement, that seems like a big stretch to me.
I agree with the skepticism. Shira, what do you think?
I mean, of course, I agree. I mean, there are so many parts to this, and the timeline is extremely ambitious. You know, reportedly, the Biden administration wants to get this done in the next 6 to 8 months, also realizing that whatever Republican support they can enlist in Congress, you know, they'll have less incentive to cooperate on this as we get closer to the U.S. Elections. And it's hard for me to rank which one of the Saudi demands is more difficult to entertain. But, you know, it's not just the civilian nuclear program. I mean, the UAE has a civilian nuclear program. They have a South Korean company had built, and now there are four, you know, nuclear plants there. It's the problem. They want no restrictions. And the no restrictions are extremely dangerous, first of all, because of the dual-use nature, right? It can be transformed into a military nuclear facility. But also think about knowledge transfers, theft. Think about an attack as similar to what we saw in Saudi, the Aramco facility, but a nuclear plant. I mean, this is you know, they're real issues here. So it's hard for me to see this on the part of the U.S. And then, of course, on the part of Israel, I think the demands, the Saudi demands, at least the public ones, have been made only from Washington. And there's an assumption that I've heard from some Israeli officials that, you know, Israel will not have to make any concessions, which I find let's say, not a good read of reality. I'm sure that if we get to a point where this becomes closer, the Saudis will make some demands of the Israelis. They cannot look like they are asking even less than the Emiratis. And I've heard a suggestion. Okay, we will just extend the promise not to annex territory as if the Saudis are, I don't know, what would the term be, slow Emiratis. Sure, we'll do what they did and take even less, just an extension of a promise. They'll probably require an Israeli concession, whether it's a declarative one, a symbolic one, or a tangible one, which this coalition will find hard to give, because there are extreme elements in this. Some parties in this coalition will see the benefits, of course, but there are other factors in this coalition that would not want to compromise on anything when it comes to the Palestinians. And of course, there are also the Palestinians themselves. And there's also remains a question if this high Saudi price tag is not just like a trial balloon, right? We don't even know that they actually want to do it. And I don't know that they want to do it, not just with Israel at this moment, which is a big question, but also with the Biden administration. They definitely are holding grudges. And while there are advantages to sort of, you know, getting out of the doghouse under a Democratic administration, there's also some personal you know, personal tension, rivalry. So the speculation is there. What could be, I mean, and I think that's what Michael and I are writing about with Evan Gottesman, our colleague. The idea is that I think we all agree that normalization between Israel and Saudi is not a question of if, it's a question of when. It will happen at one point or another. And it's incumbent on us to think how you leverage it to advance, you know, positive movements, hopefully more than that, on the Palestinian front. And this is the challenge. But it seems to me that the Saudis probably would want that. I hope the U.S. would want that. I think there are people in Israel who would want that, not necessarily the coalition, but there are people in Israel who certainly want that. And I think the Palestinians get it. It's very interesting. You know, Saudi, with the PA leadership, had also a bit of a ruckus period, and we're seeing meetings between Mahmoud Abbas and MBS, bin Salman, and interesting, you see the messages coming out of there. You see there's an opportunity here for the Palestinians to become, again, a meaningful regional topic through this process. And the question is if...
Hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully, right? If this is done right, can it be done at all? And can it be done right in 6 months? I don't know.
So it's a great, I guess, piece of political analysis and diplomatic analysis from the Saudi point of view, whether it's worthwhile to cut this kind of deal under a democratic administration, which would make it easier to get the Democrats in Congress on board, right? How can you vote against a foreign policy win for your own president, especially in an election year? Or whether from the Saudi point of view, it's worthwhile to wait to see what happens in the general election in the U.S. next year, with the idea that under a Republican president, you can likely get much more, and you don't have to hand a political foreign policy win to Biden in an election year. I don't know which answer is correct, but I do have a question for Michael. Given everything we've just laid out here, why do you think Biden administration officials even think that such a deal is possible in the next 6, 8, 10 months? What gives them actual positive vibes on this foreign policy issue?
That's a good question. I think that how to say this artfully. I think that some of the administration officials who are working on this perhaps are approaching it with a more optimistic view than necessarily a realistic view. And I also think that, you know, even if people do have a realistic view of it, we've all read the countless memoirs from administration officials, you know, across administrations going back decades, about how tantalizing the idea of an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal is, right? And even when it looks like it's impossible, people throw themselves into it because it seems such a shiny object. I think right now, Israel-Saudi normalization is similar. And it's such an attractive thing to try to work on. You know, who doesn't want to be the official in the administration that's able to secure this thing? And particularly when you throw in that we're getting close to a presidential election, and you know, I think on the Biden administration's part, you know, they want to do something, especially if it ends up being Trump on the other side, they want to do something to kind of eclipse the Abraham Accords. And I think that by any measure, Israelis, Americans, people around the region would view an Israeli-Saudi deal as eclipsing that. I think it's so attractive politically. It's so attractive from a policy perspective. I think people may be a bit blinded by the glare of it. And listen, there's always a risk in kind of upping these expectations. You know, I have to say, I was surprised to see administration officials, you know, leaking to Barak Ravid and other folks that they want to do this by year's end. It doesn't seem that that attainable by year's end. So, you know, like, great, say you're working on it, but they've raised these expectations now. And so what happens when 6 months from now we get to year's end and we haven't gotten it? I mean, it's just, I don't quite understand the messaging on this. And so it leads me to wonder if it's naivete, if they, you know, or if, maybe, listen, I never discount the possibility. They may be completely right. I may be completely wrong. You know, maybe they have a deal effectively in hand and they think they can close it in the next 6 months. If it happens, I'll be extremely surprised. But all of this does strike me as being a bit naive in terms of the timeline and in terms of the politics of it and in terms of everything that we know about what's being asked.
Shira, final word on this issue, especially, by the way, given what we've alluded to, the politics inside Israel, this undoubtedly even floating the idea of Israel-Saudi peace and that everyone's working very hard on it is useful for Netanyahu politically. It's a useful kind of lever to say, oh, well, we can't do this or that because we have an eye on an ultimate deal with Saudi. And yet the politics would be very complicated if Saudi asks for anything on the Palestinian issue.
I mean, as we said, I think the Saudis will ask something on the Palestinian issue. I think that there's a chance that even if the Saudis don't ask something on the Palestinian issue, the United States, if they're able to bring this to fruition, will make sure there's a Palestinian component because they don't want to look like, right? Sort of, yes. You know, there are much bigger interests here. The Saudi story is a big story. There's the great power competition with China. It's the idea is that we want to bring Saudi back to U.S. orbit. There are oil prices, right? There are bigger interests here that the U.S. wants to secure, but it's fine. If the U.S. is paying those prices and Israel gets the big reward, I think there's good reason to believe that people in the Biden administration would also want to say, wait, we don't want to look like we don't care about the Palestinians. So I think there are going to be asks, again, if we get to it. I think there are people also in the Israeli government who would be willing to do this because Saudi is the big thing. And I got to tell you, I mean, I'd be also surprised if they're able to pull this through. But I'll also be very, very happy, right? Saudi-Israeli peace is a big deal. And in times of de-escalation in the Middle East, we should all be glad about this, right? So I would be extremely happy if this were to happen. But there's the question of what's going to happen here, and if extreme elements of this coalition will be able to be convinced to support meaningful steps on the Palestinians for peace, and you know, it's going to be a tough sell to some of them, and then whether it's a good enough reason for opposition leaders who vowed not to sit with Netanyahu to go back into government for the sake not only of peace with Saudi Arabia, but also to say, and we're also advancing peace with the Palestinians. I mean, there are so many considerations here, political ones, strategic ones, at the personal level, right? Leaders on all sides. So it's going to be difficult.
I want to just you know, add a couple of things on to what I said before. First, we've seen the United States, we've seen this administration raise expectations in the U.S.-Saudi realm before that were not met, right? So ahead of Biden's trip to Israel and Saudi Arabia, the administration had all sorts of predictions about what the trip to Saudi Arabia would yield in terms of gas prices and, you know, in terms of U.S.-Saudi relations. And Biden went and, you know, he did the famous or infamous fist bump with MBS, came back, and the Saudis immediately screwed the U.S. on oil prices. So it's not as if we don't have very recent experience of misreading what the Saudis may do. And, you know, part of me wonders if that's coming into play again. And second, you know, if you are somebody in the administration who's working on Israel-Saudi stuff and, you know, you're talking to Prime Minister Netanyahu. I'm sure that Prime Minister Netanyahu has a very rosy view to impart about Israel-Saudi relations and about what he can get done. And, you know, that's fine. But if you aren't also familiar with or talking to other folks in his coalition about what they're prepared to give up in return for Saudi normalization, you're only getting half the picture, maybe not even half. I remain concerned that from the U.S. perspective, you know, we may be hearing things from the Saudis and from the Israelis that either are incomplete or that we are misreading. And, you know, it just all feeds into what I was saying before. I think this, you know, normalization before the end of the year timetable just seems very, very off to me.
Yeah. So to be determined, and obviously Saudi, Israel, U.S. relations will still remain with us, regardless of whether there's a deal or not. But the final topic I wanted to raise with you, and it's a favorite here on the Turkey Policy Pod, Erdogan is back. As many of our listeners probably know, a long-serving Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, won re-election a little over a week ago after a runoff against the opposition leader. He's now got another 5 years in power to tack on to his already 2 decades in power. So before we get into the implications of it all, I want some explanations. Michael, let's start with you. How did Erdogan win again, despite the major economic troubles in Turkey, the deadly earthquake, which we covered here earlier this year, united opposition? What happened?
So there are a few things. First of all, something that will not be unfamiliar to listeners of Israel Policy Pod, nationalism is a very strong force. The same way it is in Israel, it is in Turkey. And the opposition's bet was that those factors you just listed, the abysmal economy and the government's very poor response to the earthquake and all the government's missteps leading up to the earthquake in terms of building construction, were going to be enough to bring Erdogan down. Erdogan ran an extremely, even for him, nationalist campaign, and that seemed to be the factor. His base reacted to his nationalist appeals over kind of the pocketbook appeals, and you know we've seen that in Israel, we've seen that in the United States. That shouldn't surprise people anymore. So that's one. And by the way, it wasn't just the presidential election. The Turkish parliament, smaller nationalist parties also did much better than they have in the past. It's a much more nationalist tilting, sort of right-wing nationalist tilting parliament than it has been before. So it wasn't just in the presidential election. It was, you know, it was reflected in parliament as well. Second, the opposition candidate, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, he's been around for a long time. He managed to do a decent job of uniting these kind of 6 opposition parties together behind him as a candidate. But he's not the most dynamic of politicians. And particularly after the first round, when it went to a runoff, he made some strange decisions, some strange moves that he had not made leading up to the runoff, including kind of all of a sudden trying to take a more nationalist tone himself, and people just didn't buy it. I think ultimately, you know, a lot of people thought there should be a different candidate for president from the opposition. He performed very well leading up to the first round. But in that second round, in between the first and second round, I think he did some odd things, and that probably cost him as well. Third, Erdogan did what he's been doing for not quite two decades, but certainly for the last dozen years, which is tilting the playing field in a way that makes Turkish elections free, but not necessarily fair. And, you know, he used the apparatus of the state to dominate media coverage. There was a crazy stat that in the month leading up to that, the first round, Erdogan had something like 37 hours on the Turkish TV networks, and Kılıçdaroğlu had 37 minutes. He dominated the media, did the usual of putting Kurdish politicians in jail and non-Kurdish opposition politicians on trial. to kind of weaken the opposition. He also made it very difficult for Turks who had been displaced after the earthquake in the southeast to return, because you know you've got to go vote in your district. Turks who were displaced had a very difficult time returning to vote, and that ultimately actually may have been the decisive factor, because you know the Turks who were the most upset at Erdogan were the ones who suffered the most from the earthquake, and tens of thousands of them were not able to vote. And so you know that's kind of part of Erdogan's playbook, which is free elections but not fair elections. And so yeah, he's now got another 5 years, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about what that might mean. He is there, and he's not going anywhere.
Very interesting. Shira, now that Erdogan is back, I mean, he didn't go anywhere, but he's now been reelected. What do you think this all means both for Turkey and especially for Turkish foreign policy, including on things like Israel? What do you think?
So, of course, you know, he's become very good at getting reelected, right? So no surprise that he won another term. I do, very atypical of me, but I do want to be positive. I think it's too early to say, even though we know Erdogan, he's made some interesting appointments in his cabinet that could indicate that Turkey continues on more of a positive track, right? Turkey, there was a point where Turkey trying to advance a strategy of zero problems with the neighbors, and then it had problems with all the neighbors, and then it went on a diplomatic spree to mend ties, including with Israel. And if you look at the most interesting, and Michael, who's really a Turkey scholar, probably knows these names better, but I think there are four interesting changes in Erdogan's cabinet. So in foreign policy, there's this person, his name Hakan Fidan. He was the former head of the Turkish intelligence agency, which of course intelligence agency also is in charge of some of these, you know, the strategic ties. And he's now the new foreign minister. Ibrahim Kalin, who until now served as Erdogan's press secretary and de facto national security advisor, he's now became the head of the intelligence. And the chief of the general staff of the armed forces, Yasar Gular, he's the defense minister. And the previous, you know, the former defense minister is out. And there's also one on the domestic front, which is the one that I think Turks probably care about the most. The new economy minister, Mehmet Simsek, is an actual economist, whereas his predecessor was not. So if reports are accurate, and what Turkish interlocutors, some of them tell me, that this is a more experienced cabinet and could be more pro-West. Mm-hmm. This could indicate, you know, a positive trend, although it's probably too early to say.
Okay. So maybe some optimism, some positive developments, despite the fact that Erdogan was reelected. Michael, what do you think in terms of implications moving forward?
So I'll note that on Hakan Fidan, you know, who was the longtime head of MIT, the Turkish intelligence agency, in many ways, he more than anyone else is most responsible for the previous break between Israel and Turkey, because at this point, it's, I don't know, almost 10 years ago, 8 years ago, Israel suspected that Fidan was passing along Israeli intelligence to Iran, and that he was responsible for the exposure of Mossad agents. So he's definitely experienced. You know, so is Ibrahim Kalin, who knows the West very well. You know, Mehmet Simsek is a former economy minister. So these guys definitely have experience. But I think that you know, whether them being part of the cabinet signals that Turkey is going to turn more toward the West, that I'm not certain of quite yet. I think there are, you know, arguments in both directions. Listen, Erdogan's got to make some decisions. You know, he ran this very nationalist campaign, but he's now got 5 years. The Turkish economy is still terrible. So you know, he's got to figure out what to do about it. And you know, what he's been doing about it over the past couple of years has been repairing relations with Israel, with Saudi Arabia, with the UAE, with Egypt, although not quite as effectively there, in an effort to get investment into Turkey. So, you know, I expect that will continue until he determines that either it's not working or investment isn't coming. You know, the same thing with regard to the West. You know, right now there is this fight going on between NATO and Turkey over whether Sweden's going to be allowed into NATO. You know, that's probably, we talked earlier about Saudi-Israel normalization hinging on what the U.S. will give to the Saudis. You know, in this case, it's something similar. If the U.S. gives Turkey new F-16s and agrees to upgrade the old ones, then Turkey's going to drop its objection to Sweden joining NATO. I think that's probably going to happen. I expect that we'll see that in the next month. And that will in some ways signal that Erdogan is trying to have better relations with the West. But I think that it's all driven by the economics, right? I mean, Erdogan, we know what he is. He's been in power since 2002. He's not going to change. There aren't any surprises. You know, to the extent that he is, I think, trying to make nice, it's very instrumental. There was a really funny line in an article in the Jerusalem Post last week that was analyzing kind of what's ahead for Israel and Turkey and looked at it through the picture of potential gas deals that Israel has. You know, one is a pipeline that cooperates with Turkey, another is the Cyprus-Greece pipeline, which at this point seems to be completely economically unviable. Another is to ship Israeli gas to Cyprus, and they have an LNG facility that can convert it into liquid, and then you ship it to Europe. But there was a funny line in the piece, you know, and it was something, I don't remember it exactly, but it was something along the lines of, you know, Israel has to decide whether it can trust someone, you know, who used to be one of the biggest and loudest anti-Semites in the world. So he used to be, and all of a sudden he's you know, had a excuse the expression when we're talking about anti-Semitism, a come to Jesus moment, you know, at the age of 70. I just don't buy it. So I think that he's not going to blow up relations with Israel tomorrow or next month or, you know, even necessarily next year. But at some point, you know, if he manages to turn the economy around and he doesn't necessarily think Israel is the key to that, I think we'll be right back to where we used to be. And, you know, some of the folks in his inner circle certainly have a challenging relationship with Israel in the past and a challenging relationship with the West. So it remains to be seen, but Erdogan definitely it's in his hands, right? With regard to the West, with regard to Israel, it's up to him.
So if I remember correctly, on this podcast, that you and Shira actually had a disagreement over Erdogan and whether the rapprochement with Israel would hold or not. So far it's holding, but it seems like you're still skeptical, Michael.
I remain skeptical in the long term.
Okay. Noted on the Turkey policy pod.
Yeah, but in the long term, it's not fair because we had this argument and I'm still waiting for Michael to eat that hat. You said, go back to listening to it, that if, you know, over Jerusalem and Gaza, and we've been through a few of those, and whatever Erdogan thinks in his head, 100%. He's been holding to hold it inside, which is all I need from him. I don't care what he thinks. I just don't want him not to act on it.
Yeah, 100%, Shira, you were correct. I was not. I expected by this point, particularly in the lead up to the election, for Erdogan to have manufactured a fight with Israel. He did not do that.
So let it be on the record. Yeah, and we can turn the cameras on and you will
on the record.
That hat.
on the record, and Shira, when I see you in a couple of weeks, if you want, I'm happy to buy you some sort of token to acknowledge that you were right enough.
No, it just doesn't happen very often that we argue and I am right.
So But I still remain pessimistic that things are going to continue along this path. I just, again, maybe I am being led astray by the fact that I've been watching this guy for such a long time, but you know, leopards don't change their spots, and I'm waiting for him to revert to form.
So regardless of what happens in Israel-Turkey relations, when we all see each other later this month, a bucket hat will be purchased and and some hummus will be spread on it, and Michael Coppola will have to eat said bucket hat.
I'll buy you a chocolate hat.
Thank you, Shira.
So on that note, thank you both for your time. And yes, on Turkey and these other issues, we'll have to discuss it further next month in the coming months. So thank you both again.
Thanks, Mary. Thanks, Shira.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Mary. Bye.
Bye. Okay, thanks again to Michael Coppola and Shira Efron, as always. Also, a special thanks to our producer, Jacob Gilman, and to all of you who support Israel Policy Forum's work, including this podcast. You know who you are. Just remember to subscribe. Please leave a rating and comment. That always helps. And as always, thank you for listening.